Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. If our big box hardware stores are any indication, we love to do things ourselves, or at least we think we can do them ourselves. I once made a flea trap with stuff I bought at the dollar store, and it worked like a charm. It's still one of my proudest moments. How about you?
I think I've been using Pinterest too much.
I thought it would be fun to make a tattoo gun, electric toothbrush, mechanical pencil head, and a guitar string.
You slice wine corks.
Cut a hole in a shoebox. I used gray thread.
And I put some apples and some chicken nuggets in it.
It broke, the needle broke, and duct tape.
Wasn't it quite the right size? So I put two popsicle sticks under it.
Instead of using spackle, use bread.
Then I practice with some practice material.
And it keeps the flies away. Bloody fantastic.
I've made my own bicycle twice.
I made this dress, actually.
That's all very impressive, but have you ever edited genes?
I really mutated bacteria. There actually is something that's going on in there. We're seeing science happen.
Our show today is about doing it yourself in health and science. Birders creating a massive online map for scientists, people kicking a drug habit without any medical help, an amateur historian obsessed with getting recognition for an unsung science hero. But let's start with gene editing, not in a fancy high-tech lab, but done by you, in the comfort of your home or maybe a classroom. You've probably heard of the gene editing tool called CRISPR, but let's get a quick recap from somebody who has firsthand experience.
Gene editing and engineering to change genes in a way that it can now do things it couldn't do before.
That's 12-year-old Hannah Fixon. Yes, she is 12. That's kind of obnoxious, but she successfully did a gene editing experiment at her school. And as Alan Yu explains, you too can learn how to do this. He went to a class in Brooklyn to check it out.
I'm at a community lab called GenSpace. It's a classroom, two rows of tables, a whiteboard, and there's two strings of Christmas lights hanging on one side, twisted to form the DNA double helix. It's a four-week class on gene editing with a small group of 10.
And then I was like, this is so cool to learn about. I hadn't studied biology since ninth grade.
The participants go around the room to introduce themselves and their background.
For work, I'm a software engineer.
I just got my master's in plant biology.
I'm a medical student up at Boston University.
I work in pharmaceutical advertising. I'm a high school sophomore.
I'm a high school junior.
I don't have a job because I'm still in eighth grade.
Lab manager Will Schindel is teaching the class. He says usually the people who take the class are professionals who want a new career skill, or
everyday people who have just heard about CRISPR on the news. They just know that it's this word that everybody's throwing around, and it's either going to lead to the singularity or the apocalypse. And so they'd like to know, you know,
which one it is.
Yeah, which one it is.
Will offers a quick history lesson on CRISPR, then it's off to the lab. Each student puts on gloves. Okay, I'm going to simplify what they do next a lot. Their assignment is to genetically alter yeast to turn the organisms red. To do this, they are mixing three things. One, a small circle of DNA that carries the instructions for making an enzyme that does the gene editing. Two, a short bit of DNA that marks the part of the yeast genome they want to edit. It's a little bit like a cursor in a word processor that finds and highlights the word you want to change. And three, another enzyme that acts like glue to stick the short bit of DNA to the circle. They are mixing all these with a pipette, which you can think of as an expensive straw that sucks up precise and small volumes of liquid measured in microliters, which is a millionth of a liter. In one corner, software engineer Ruthie Nakmani is working with Tina Lai.
Does this look like okay? It has some bubbles.
That's okay, I wouldn't worry too much.
You can tap it down just a little.
After about an hour of mixing, they dump the liquid with the transformed bacteria onto a petri dish. they roll some sterile glass beads around their petri dishes to spread the bacteria solution all over the surface.
And now everyone's gonna shake their plates. And they're gonna shake the beads around on the plate, and the beads are going to track bacteria all over the plate and coat the surface.
Then the petri dishes go in an incubator. They close the door, and the dishes sit there overnight, then they go in the fridge, and the students won't find out if it worked or not right away. But you don't have to take a class to try this out. There are kits you can buy online, so this is happening in other places, like at schools. Abby Pierce is 13 years old and she goes to Acera, an elementary and middle school in Massachusetts. She changed bacteria so they could grow with an antibiotic that would have otherwise killed them.
It was kind of funny because I was talking to one of my friend's science teachers and she was actually really surprised that we got to use CRISPR.
She says kids at other schools are learning about CRISPR, but she actually got to do it. The science teacher at their school is Michael Hirsch. Last year, he started teaching molecular biology using kits from a company called Amino. One experiment involved leaving some bacteria overnight.
Then they came in the next day and a culture that was yellow suddenly was red. It's like, whoa, what happened there? And so I think it started to click like, oh, wait a minute, there actually is something that's going on in there. We're seeing science happen. I really mutated bacteria, and they love that the idea that, you know, they mutated something.
He says kits from companies like Amino are taking science from labs and putting it in classrooms and homes.
I told the folks in my school that Amino is going to do for biology what the PC did for personal computing. We could do things like create pigments and create flavor extracts and all of these really nifty things safely and carefully in our kitchens. You know, if you were to 50 years ago say that everyone in their home had a computer, you know, I think they'd all look at you like computer manufacturers look at you like you're crazy.
Now, he's not the only one comparing gene editing tools to computers. A lot of people have talked about this, and it's bubbled over to different spaces. And just like with personal computing, people are now dreaming about and starting synthetic biology projects. Will, the lab manager at Genspace, is working on one with some friends.
It was just something that we blurted out over a couple of beers. What if we could give basil weird flavors? We could make vanilla basil or spicy basil. And we're like, no, spicy basil, that doesn't seem like a good idea. What about a spicy tomato?
Will has some tomato plants growing in the lab in Brooklyn, and his team is trying to figure out how to edit their genes. Some people are trying to make bacteria produce insulin. That sounds exciting, right? But before we get too carried away, we have to remember that bacteria are not as predictable as computers. I talked to Christella Prather. She's a chemical engineer at MIT, and her team does synthetic biology all the time. She says even her grad students struggle. Living things are just a lot more complex than computer code.
One of the common mistakes that people make is assume all water is just water, right? The water that comes out of the tap in Cambridge is different from the water that comes out of the tap in New York. And that's because of a number of reasons of of the source of it as well as how it's processed. So there are very small things like that that can turn out to make a significant difference.
Now, don't get me wrong, she's also excited about how kits and classes are bringing synthetic biology to everyone.
I was a 13-year-old kid who had a Commodore 64 computer, and I could write my own computer programs to do all sorts of interesting things, and I didn't really need anything other than the computer.
She says even if all these kits do right now is get more people excited about becoming scientists, it's still really valuable. Now, there's one other thing. Remember what Will, the lab manager, said about how some people think of CRISPR?
It's either going to lead to the singularity or the apocalypse.
And the apocalypse part is what worries some people. For example, in Germany, you cannot use these kits at home. You have to be in a licensed facility or you face a fine of up to $54,000. The European Center for Disease Prevention and Control disagrees and says the risk to people using these kits is low. It asked EU member states to review their procedures around these kits. I talked about security with Justin Pereira. He's the co-founder of Amino, one of the kit companies. and now he has a fellowship from Johns Hopkins University to work on biosecurity.
DIY bio and biohacking and, you know, whatever we're calling it, it's still in the very early stage. And from a security standpoint, it's really nothing to be concerned about in the near point.
He was just at a workshop in Washington, D.C. with people from academia, industry, and government agencies like the CDC, the FBI, and the UK Ministry of Defense. He says, generally speaking, the US and Canada have been very supportive of the DIY space.
You have a lot more people becoming educated in the area who are possible creators of amazing technologies and whatnot in the future. To kind of counter this, what we see in Europe and specifically in Germany, there's a very high regulation around DIY bio, which again, I don't think is a security risk. But by regulating it, they're also stifling innovation.
Justin says the goal of his company Amino is to teach these skills to as many people as possible, because we have some pretty big problems to solve, and the more people we can get to work on them, the better. He says science has progressed quite a bit, but imagine how much more progress we could make if we had tens of thousands of more scientists working on these problems.
I'm personally invested in this because my grandfather, he died of cancer when I was really young, and it really affected me. And it's been kind of my dream to solve cancer and have some of these big discoveries to prevent people from harm.
And who knows, maybe some of the scientists we need might start with classes at GenSpace or learning to edit genes using a kit in middle school. For The Pulse, I'm Alan Yu.
And perfect way to play us out, a song about CRISPR that is also a DIY project. CRISPR Cas9, bring me a gene, encoding for a specific protein. Make a few snips at this coded locus. You work so well inside a streptococcus. Physics student Tim Blaze makes parody songs about science, and he sings every part himself. Check out his YouTube channel, Acapella Science. We're talking about do-it-yourself style approaches to health and science today. And when a new technique like CRISPR comes out, we want to credit the people who worked on it. Usually it's a lot of scientists who all built on each other's work, and they each get a mention in the grand book of history called Wikipedia. In climate science, there's a name that's not very well known.
No one has found a picture of Eunice.
No?
No.
Eunice is Eunice Foote, who lived in the 19th century, and this guy here has become obsessed with her scientific contributions.
My name is James Daly. Everyone calls me Jimbo. I'm an unaffiliated, unpublished, amateur historian.
Jimbo, or James, has made it his business to piece together the events of Eunice's life and to get her more attention as her field, climate science, has come under attack. He carries stacks of notebooks where he has jotted down his research notes.
Oh, wow. This is a timeline you made?
Yes, yes. She was born in Goshen, Connecticut, but then her father...
Through his sleuthing, James has found out that Eunice went to a prestigious girls' school. It's now called the Emma Willard School, and that's probably where her interest in science was sparked. She and her husband Elijah, who is also a hobby scientist, lived in Seneca Falls, and they were both drawn to the cause of women's equality.
They are both signers to the Declaration of Sentiments at the Seneca Falls Convention, the world's first women's rights convention.
That was in 1848, and soon after, Eunice completed a series of simple but impressive experiments establishing that CO2 is a heat-trapping gas.
This is replicated in high schools around the world every day today, and it looks like she is the first one to do this experiment. Her husband was working on studying what light is, so he's putting thermometers every which way he can think of, in and out of the shadows. And so here's all these thermometers, here's these containers. She gets the idea to put different gases into these containers and put a thermometer in them. Some of them, she puts them all in the sun. Some of them heat up. Some of them heat up a little more. And then she notices that CO2 just skyrockets above all the other gases. And then when you take them out of the sun, it retains the heat even longer.
And where is she doing this?
This is at Seneca Falls, right there at her house. It looks like her neighbor had some of the equipment, some of the pumps and stuff. It was tiny little crossroads out in the middle of rural New York, but crossroads it was.
How was she documenting her experiments? Where do you find evidence of the work she was doing?
All we have on her science is two small little papers. They are not very extensive, but amazing in what a wallop they pack. It got her recognized by the greatest name of American science of the 19th century, Joseph Henry.
He was the first director of the Smithsonian and presented Eunice's paper at the meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1856. And he made this a case in point to include women in science. He said, science was of no country and of no sex.
Do we have anything from her, her diaries, anything else other than those two papers?
We have remarkably little. What is beautiful to find is how tied into the American scientific community they were. There were these relations that kept on for decades. And everyone is asked what happened to her after these two little papers, because the trail seems to go cold. And what I'm finding is that she was with a life of science.
Meaning Eunice Foote continued to do scientific work, and that's where hobby historian James Daly really wants to fill in this story. And he's not the only one out there pushing for recognition for Eunice. The University of California, Santa Barbara is currently working on an exhibit about her. Every day, thousands of Americans addicted to opioids are trying to kick the habit. And there is professional help available, a $35 billion addiction treatment industry.
Are you or a loved one struggling with an alcohol or drug addiction?
It was Oxys for me.
I used crack cocaine.
Malibu, we treat and heal the underlying causes of addiction.
If you have insurance or the ability to pay for 30 days of treatment, National Rehab Recovery can change your life. Medicare and Medicaid are not accepted at this time.
Despite those ubiquitous ads, getting into treatment isn't easy. It can be really expensive. There are state and city-funded programs, but they often have waiting lists and limited beds. So could doing it yourself be the answer?
I made a conscious decision that I would not take anything for the pain or for the withdrawals. I decided to kick a habit cold turkey.
That's Elvis Rosado. Alana Gordon caught up with him to find out how this DIY approach worked out for him.
Elvis grew up in North Philly, the Badlands, a part of town well known for drugs. He was in his teens when he developed a deep affinity for what was then called pancakes and syrup, codeine.
I actually had, and I'm going to have to say, a relationship, a love relationship with codeine.
Elvis quickly became addicted. Soon, he was selling drugs to support his habit. And by the time he was 25, he was in jail.
I was like, I have to kick this. I have to break this.
But he didn't ask for help from the jail's clinic staff, who could have given him meds for the withdrawal symptoms. For him, if he took anything...
In my head, I was like, I'm still using.
So began the most intense physical and mental experience he could have imagined.
The first day is gradual. It's like the onset of the flu.
But then that flu, it went on steroids.
By 12 hours, I literally felt like not only did I have the flu, but I had a stomach virus and God knows what else. It was a difficult night. Hour 16, hour 20. The sweats, the running nose, the throwing up, the physical pain. You start shaking even more, going on yourself, feces and urinating yourself. The symptoms are horrific. It just gets really, really bad. The stomach cramps. It's like having Freddy Krueger inside you trying to rip his way out.
Did you worry that it was going to kill you?
No, I don't think I ever worried about that. I had days where I felt like I wish I was dead.
But then came the next phase, the temptation to slide back.
I tell myself that if I do a little bit, maybe I can gradually detox myself or get myself off of it, and it would be so much easier. Take something, take a little bit.
Anxiety kicked in. Take something, take a little. He couldn't sleep.
Just took all my clothes off and laid naked on the cold floor.
When he finally could get to bed, drugs took over his dreams.
Even though I wasn't using, my thoughts were still corrupted. There's something missing, there's something missing. There's something missing, there's something missing.
It's certainly uncomfortable, and most people can't tolerate it.
This is Kyle Campton. He's a psychiatrist who specializes in addiction at the University of Pennsylvania. He says detoxing from opioids without medical support or medications to ease the withdrawal symptoms has an extremely low success rate. But is it dangerous?
For people who are healthy, it's generally not a life-threatening condition.
Yes, the diarrhea and vomiting from withdrawing can make you dehydrated. That can lead to severe complications, even deaths. He also worries about the big risks of patients trying to self-medicate to avoid these side effects or drug cravings. But his biggest concern?
What bothers me most about thinking that detox is adequate treatment is that we know that it just doesn't work.
Some studies show the relapse rate is upwards of 90% without prescribed meds and monitoring to control the withdrawal, something that can take months, even years. And if the patient goes back to using, there's a higher risk of overdose. Addiction, he says, isn't something you can just flush out of your body. It's a disease.
Room seven is empty.
Dr. Fred Bauer has been treating people with this disease for 30 years.
I think the term detox has negative connotations.
He says we need to abandon the whole notion of detox, DIY or not.
I think detox was thought of more as a treatment, like you go to detox and then you're supposed to be well. And that's a really pernicious myth. This is where the doctor will interview patients.
Fred is medical director at Kirkbride, a big recovery center in Philadelphia.
Their medications are controlled, the environment is controlled.
Detox here is a lot more than getting the drugs out of your system.
Chart room, these are patient charts.
It's counseling, and perhaps most important, medications like methadone to manage the cravings. But Fred says there's no one formula.
We have to really consider all the tools that are out there to support someone in getting well.
For Elvis Rosado, he recalls first developing coping tools in jail. The bars protected him from the temptations of his old neighborhood. He found support groups and counseling. Still, he says doing a DIY detox without medical support or prescribed medicine worked for him. But he wasn't entirely alone. He credits his long-term success to a very specific conversation he had while he was still locked up. It came during a phone call with his girlfriend.
And she goes, I'm pregnant. What are we going to do about it? And I said, you know, we keep the baby.
Elvis recalls making a promise to himself in that moment to be a good father. And for him, at least, that's worked. He recently celebrated 25 years drug-free.
Hey, puppy.
That was Alana Gordon reporting.
Are you okay?
Yeah, all good. Just wanted to get you out. Get on the road soon to go back home.
Please be safe on the road and do me a favor. Call me when you get back to Houston.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, definitely keep me posted, all right?
Will do. You got it.
All right. Love you, kid.
Today we're talking about DIY in health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. What do you do when you don't feel well for a couple of days? You probably go to the doctor and they usually say, let me order a couple of tests and check you out. But what if you could just order those tests yourself without a referral? That is now possible in a couple of states, and health economists say it may be part of a larger trend in healthcare. But is this a good idea? Alex Smith gave it a shot.
And then you're going to put in your first name, so it's Alex, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the waiting room of a medical testing lab in Kansas City, phlebotomist Kristen Wyrock shows me how to check in with an iPad. About an hour earlier, I filled out an online form to get a test for hepatitis C. I don't have any reason to think I've got it, but I thought I'd check, at least for this story. Now I'm here to get my blood taken.
There we go. Are you all right?
Yeah.
Okay.
This lab is part of Quest Diagnostics, a national giant in the world of medical testing. It recently started a pilot program in Missouri and Colorado offering lab tests you can order yourself, no doctor's note required. Before the program started, a lot of people would show up at the lab asking for tests without checking with their physician first.
And I've said, I'm sorry, we have to have an order from a doctor. We're not set up that way. Uh-huh. And, you know, I'm like, I can't do anything else. Sorry. Sometimes they're a little irritated.
But me, all I had to do was ask. Kristen Wyrock filled a vial with my blood, and her work is done. She charges my credit card $59. The price goes from $25 to $128, depending on the test. It takes just 5 minutes, and I'll get the results a week or so later. It's definitely convenient, but am I missing something by not going through my family doctor? So I asked a physician.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Michael Munger, and I'm president-elect of the American Academy of Family Physicians.
The doctor says he's seen a shift in his patients in recent years. Many are trying at-home tests, researching medical issues on their own, sometimes questioning his advice, and he says he's okay with that.
I encourage patients to push back. I really enjoy when they say, well, wait a minute, are you sure? I don't understand that. What are you talking about?
But Michael Munger says there's a danger in patients going too rogue with their health care. He says his job is looking at his patient's entire health history, and that's something you can't get from individual lab tests. Plus, without a doctor's expertise, the results of individual lab tests can be hard to decode.
I always try to educate my patients that any time they go to receive any test, I want a chance to sit down and talk to them, look at the trends, put that into the overall scope of where that fits in for their health care and what those results really mean.
The testing company Quest tells patients to share results with their doctors, and the tests offered are pretty routine, things like glucose and thyroid screening. These aren't the controversial tests sold online, the ones claiming to spot rare cancers or figure out your genetic predisposition to certain diseases. Kathy Doherty from Quest says tests initiated by the patient could help people stay healthy.
Maybe they've been identified as, you know, on the brink of high cholesterol, are on the brink of diabetes, and they've taken action to alter their, to impact their behaviors as it relates to exercise and diet, and they want to see if it's making a difference.
Industry watchers say these tests could be the beginning stages of a huge shift.
That is part of do-it-yourself or DIY healthcare.
That's health economist Jane Sarrison-Khan. She says these DIY tests are like weight loss apps on your phone or Fitbit. They make it cheap and easy for people to get their own health data when they used to depend on doctors. Jane Sarrison-Khan has been talking with hospitals and doctors and telling them to get on board with the trend. She says their willingness typically depends on one thing, the way they get paid.
If the doctor gets paid in a fee-for-service world, that is, every task the doctor does with a patient has a payment attached to it, then doctors really aren't so keen on consumers doing more for themselves.
She says, on the other hand, if doctors want to bring overall health costs down, they might actually encourage patients to seek out their own medical tests or do self-monitoring.
When we align the incentives of physicians, doctors, insurers, hospitals together, so everyone's on the same page to benefit the patient to get well, these tools will be increasingly adopted.
So how did DIY testing go for me?
Okay, so it's about a week and a half after I did the test, and I am going to go on the Quest Diagnostic website, and I'm looking around, and here we go.
Decoding the test results was not actually as easy as I hoped. I imagined something like a red flashing sign on the website saying, you don't have hepatitis C. Instead, I had to do a Google search to find out what the numbers I got back meant. And it turns out I don't have hep C. I was never actually at risk, and now I'm out $59. There's a risk that DIY testing will just burn a hole in the pocket of hypochondriacs or maybe journalists. They'll end up buying expensive tests for medical problems they don't have. For The Pulse, I'm Alex Smith.
do it yourself. That's what we're talking about on the show today. And you know the old saying, necessity is the mother of invention. And it also often spurs us to new DIY heights. That's true for teenage rock climbing prodigy Hugh Herr.
He was known across the country, and he was one of the best athletes on the East Coast. And then he wandered into a wilderness area during a snowstorm and got lost and got frostbite and lost both his legs below the knees.
Adam Piori writes about you in his new book, The Bodybuilders. So doctors told you things would never be the same, he would never rock climb again, but you wasn't buying that.
He immediately began tinkering with his prosthetics so he could get back on the climbing wall. He made some that were about 7 feet long. He made them with little blades that could stick into crevices. And he kind of became augmented, and he became an even better rock climber than he was before because he was lighter and he had these specially designed prosthetics. But he was very frustrated when he would come down on the ground and put back on what's essentially a peg leg with the same kind of thing that people had been using for hundreds of years. And so he had always been like a C&D student in high school, but he started to read and study, and he became a straight-A student in community college and eventually went on to MIT, got a PhD, and now he is one of the leading prosthetics designers in the world.
What was his approach to designing prosthetics?
What he did basically is he built a mathematical model of how all the constituent parts of the human leg fit together. You know, if your knee goes forward an inch and your ankle is at this angle and you press down with this amount of force, you know, what happens to the foot? He put this mathematical model into a computer chip and put that chip in these robotic limbs, and basically they react and respond like a human leg would. It's like a sleek mass of wires and shiny metal. It's got a little thing on the bottom. The foot kind of looks like a flip-flop. When I first visited him, I went for a walk with him, and I couldn't even see the legs. He was wearing fancy Italian leather shoes and some nice slacks, and it was hard to keep up with him.
And could you tell at all that these legs that he was walking on were prosthetics?
I mean, I could hear a little squeaking sometimes, like it was, you know, the machinery moving and adjusting. But that's about it. He looked normal, and that was the point. He sort of built a model of the biomechanics of the human body and tried to replicate that.
And how does you talk about what happened to him or his injury, or how does he perceive his life without legs, basically?
You know, for Hugh Herr, he loved to run. And when he first got injured, he would wake up after having dreamed that he was running through the cornfield behind his house with the wind blowing in his hair and realized he would never run again. And now he jogs every day on prosthetic limbs. But he talks about them. He thinks that they're more beautiful than the real thing, he says. He doesn't see himself as limited in any way.
And did he talk about what he wants to do next? What's his next hope for these artificial limbs?
After he built the legs, one of the things that he did in recent months was to come up with a new prosthesis. Well, I guess it's called an orthosis, maybe. It's an exoskeleton-like device for people who have able-bodied limbs, and it feeds energy into your ankle every time you take a step so that you expend less energy. So he's interested in not just restoring lost function, but also augmenting function. And he says that 50 years from now, when we want to go visit a friend across town, we're not going to get in a metal box with four wheels and drive there. We'll just strap on some device and jog.
Adam Piori writes about rock climber Hugh Herr in his new book, The Bodybuilders: Inside the Science of the Engineered Human. Coming up...
Oh, so that's a beautiful yellow-rumped warbler, Murta warbler.
Birders always keep track of what they observe.
I've seen multiple individuals. They have a little yellow rump patch. Some people call them butter butts for that.
And now they can enter those butter butts into a gigantic online database. That's next on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. CTCA offers genomic testing to help doctors determine treatment options based on patients' personal genetic makeup. Genomic tumor assessment may hold the key to help patients improve quality of life and discover more precise treatment options that were previously not considered. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
This is the Paul's Stories About the People and Places at the Heart of Health and Science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're exploring do-it-yourself approaches. And what's more DIY than citizen science? It means all of us can participate in projects that advance knowledge in the scientific community. Checking for pests on trees, counting fireflies, measuring the depth of a river. It's the kind of stuff nature enthusiasts love to do anyway. And then their observations contribute to a larger cause. Paige Flager introduces us to birders who are using their well-trained eyes and ears to create a gigantic online map.
Holly Merker's eyes are constantly on the treetops.
Wow, this is a wren. It's moving in. See how, look at it. It's putting its wings up. It's displaying. It looks like, there's another one.
We're in the woods at a wildlife refuge in Philadelphia. Holly has more gear on than a movie production crew. She has a huge camera draped over one arm and binoculars hanging from her neck. Her spotting scope, which is basically as tall as she is perched up on her shoulder.
Ooh.
She spots a bird and quickly starts snapping photos. Another bird sings behind her and she turns and starts recording the sound on her iPhone. Next, she opens up an app called eBird. Holly's using it to count all of the different birds that she's seen on our walk.
So right now I'm putting in, I can hear Carolina wren singing, and I want to put like a value for some of the yellow rumps that we were seeing and some of the black and white warblers. So I'm going to enter in the number 9 for that little path right there. Lots of red-winged blackbirds. So I'm just typing in these numbers. I'm tapping the number value to increase it as I go along.
And I spoke with some of her friends who are doing the same thing.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's a nice way to keep track of what you've seen.
I have my eBird list this morning right now. It's, you know, a mobile app. And as I see birds, I just, you know.
Oh, it was like already up on your home screen.
Yeah, exactly. Of course.
Yes.
The whole time.
And then at the end. Holly and her friends are just a few of the 630,000 birders around the world who use this app to report the birds they've seen. The collected bird counts are free and available to scientists.
We are gathering up this information, we're collecting this data, and we're just amateurs, but we're able to contribute with science. So it's a perfect marriage, I'd say, between, you know, a hobbyist birder like myself and professional ornithologists and researchers.
eBird is the digital darling of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. To attract birders to contribute, the lab made it like a game.
I've actually always used Pokemon as a way to explain birding to people.
That's Ian Davies, eBird's project coordinator.
In Pokemon, you learn 150 different kinds of creatures. You learn where to find them in the environment, and then you go and you collect them. And in birding, it's almost the same thing, but there's 10,000 species of birds. They're all around the world, and they're real, which is another great part. And by observing them, you both get kind of the satisfaction of seeing something new, but also through eBird of contributing to something larger.
Birders from Kansas to New Jersey contributed data to Scott Taylor's study. He's a researcher at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He used eBird data to show that warming winter temperatures are forcing two species of chickadees further north.
There's a lot of challenges that people who study birds face, and one of those is that you can only be in so many places at one time. But eBird increases our ability to look across entire regions of contact between species.
Scott says that without eBird, the field research would have taken a lot more time and a lot more money. Over the last decade, eBird basically provided them eyes and ears all over the country. Scientists like Scott want the help from everyday citizens, but they need to know that the information is accurate. Avid birder Holly Merker from earlier is the data reviewer for the entire state of Pennsylvania. eBird will flag an unusual sighting, like if I entered that I thought I saw an ostrich by the Liberty Bell, and then Holly would go in and either verify what I saw or explain to me why I probably got it wrong. That way, the birders will learn from their mistakes and the data quality will get better. After a few hours of birding, Holly puts the final touches on her eBird list for the day.
I'm going to hit this button right here, which says submit, and it's submitting to eBird. And now Cornell Lab of Ornithology has my data.
Does it feel good every time you hit that submit button?
You know, it really does. It really does. I love being able to contribute. Hitting that submit button is pretty awesome for me. Yeah.
So nerdy.
No, it is totally nerdy, bird nerds, but, you know, hey, I love it.
That's Paige Flager reporting. You're listening to The Pulse. When the plant you're trying to cultivate has been illegal forever, you're sort of forced into the DIY realm. Maybe you're learning your craft in a backyard with a really high fence or in a basement with a very strong growing light. You get where I'm going with this, marijuana. But as this drug is becoming more mainstream and is being legalized in many states as a serious treatment for a long list of ailments, marijuana breeders are beginning to augment whisper down the lane wisdom with serious science to validate the potency and purity of their cannabis. Andrew Stelzer reports.
In 2009, 3 years out of college, Mitchell Stern quit his job as a journalist in D.C. and moved to California, hoping to join the Green Rush, the exploding medical marijuana industry.
I started as an unsuccessful flower grower.
He'd never grown weed before. His product just couldn't compete with growers with years of experience. Mitchell searched for information on how to grow good, powerful cannabis. He even pored through old college textbooks. But his real education began when he got a job as a security guard at a marijuana shop that sold small starter plants.
And every morning, all the growers would be sitting there waiting for their turn in line, and each of them would be talking to the other about, oh, I'm trying this light, I'm trying these nutrients. I just figured out this, you know, new technique or whatever. So I would sit there every morning and listen and take it all in.
This is how marijuana knowledge has been passed on for generations, in whispered tips and secrets between a trusted circle of peers. With that word-of-mouth information, Mitchell slowly built his own cannabis company, Burning Bush Nurseries. Nowadays, his seeds and starter plants are good. So good that you can find his brand on the shelves of one of the largest medical marijuana dispensaries in the world, the legendary Harborside Health Center in Oakland.
Next patient, please.
Mitchell says the industry has changed. Today, hundreds of thousands of patients across the country queue up to cure all sorts of ills. It's become crucial to know exactly what's in each dose of cannabis. It's no longer just stoners looking to get the best high.
Now that cannabis is becoming more socially acceptable and people are using it more and more, people want to know that their medicine is safe.
Just about everything sold here, from hash to cookies to gummy candy, is now labeled with information about what's inside. Stephen D'Angelo is founder of Harborside. He says his two medical marijuana dispensaries grossed over $40 million last year. Harborside sells some 60 types of cannabis and extracts with names like Blue Dream, Ghost OG, and False Teeth. Stephen D'Angelo says it's pretty important to choose the right strain.
The kind of cannabis that's good for PTSD, for example, you wouldn't want to use on children with epilepsy, because what you want to do is quell their seizures, not have them lose their memory.
Parents and patients want to know, what is it and how much is in there? And that's why chemist Terry Deng is preparing a sample of cannabis for potency testing. She's part of the lab team at CW Analytical. Inside an unmarked warehouse in Oakland, it looks like your typical science lab, filled with vials and beeping machines, except everyone has on black lab coats instead of white.
So the sonicator helps us break down and extract the cannabinoids. So basically there's ultrasonic waves that are being pushed through the water, and it helps just kind of break down the sample into smaller particles.
To find out how strong a strain of marijuana is, the lab tests for two main things, cannabinoids and terpenes. Cannabinoids are compounds that affect the body's chemistry and the mind. The most well-known cannabinoid is THC. That's the one that gets you high, so to speak. Terpenes are oils in marijuana. They change both the smell and taste of the drug. For $200, professional growers can get that potency analysis done on their cannabis and test for impurities.
Cannabinoid profiling, microbiological analysis, pesticide analysis, terpene analysis, and residual solvent analysis.
That's Emily Richardson from CW Analytical. She says testing cannabis this way has only been done for the past few years. It used to be just law enforcement agencies testing THC levels for criminal cases.
Now, we're approaching it from a quality assurance standpoint and a consumer safety standpoint.
CW does provide data on potency, but then it's the growers and dispensaries who take that information and use it to market their products. At the dispensary counter, patients get advice on what strain might be more appropriate for pain relief versus insomnia. There's not a lot of validated science on that health advice, but these million-dollar labs have given the industry information on the chemical makeup of their cannabis. So before that, how did you know what was in that pipe or batch of pot brownies?
The only testing methods we had was to smoke a joint. Which one was going to be more potent?
That's Stephen D'Angelo, who owns the big medical dispensary. He's been in the marijuana business for 40 years and says some commonly held beliefs and urban legends have been confirmed by rigorous science, but other assumptions have turned out not to be true. For example, the purple strains, like Purple Urkel, Granddaddy Purple, Purple Kush, were thought to be incredibly potent. But turns out, they're relatively low in THC content.
It was really challenging in the beginning for these do-it-yourself breeders to really identify what was happening with these different strains.
So far, these modern science labs only test for quality. It will be up to clinical researchers and big universities to definitively determine which strains help with different health conditions like Alzheimer's or multiple sclerosis. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhuroff, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. We had editing help from Kate Concannon and help producing this week's show from Alex Stern. So obviously, we believe in professional help here at The Pulse, but this guy, not so much.
We had a clogged drain, and my dad couldn't get it like with snake or chemicals, so he used a shotgun to clear the drain. He shot it. He shot up the drain, and it worked.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Paige Flager our associate producer, Tanya English the managing editor, and Megan Pinto the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. I have to think about that for a second. Yes. I almost said I'm making stuff. That should be my name for this episode. I'm making stuff. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Penn Musculoskeletal Center supports WHYY. At the Penn Musculoskeletal Center, Penn doctors, specialists, and therapists work side by side to diagnose and treat problems with joints, muscles, and bones. They take a whole body approach and consider a full range of options beyond just surgery. More information is available about the Penn Musculoskeletal Center at pennmedicine.org/MSK. Your life, a life in motion, is worth Penn Medicine. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org. Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.